The Pro Wrestling Stories Podcast.
Welcome to the Pro Wrestling Stories Podcast, where we transport you to nostalgic moments of wrestling's past. You can listen to the show on all major podcast platforms and follow Pro Wrestling Stories on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Stories and also on Twitter, PWS_official. I'm Chris Toplak. He's Corey Rivard. When it comes to playing a pivotal role in the development of the Attitude Era, Brian Pillman's name needs to be near the top of that list. If Steve Austin was Nirvana, I believe Brian Pillman was the Pixies. Mm-hmm. Corey, what are your memories of Brian and his influence
Where
on the Attitude
Brian's
Era?
Where is Brian's mind, Chris? Where is Brian's mind?
Oh, that ties in well to this episode, Corey.
For Brian Pillman, I remember him coming for a lot longer than he was staying, I would say. He was always on his way to doing something incredible, but we never got to enjoy him at his peak.
He did not have a long career. I mean, he was in Stampede Wrestling, as we know. He later joined WCW, ECW, WWE or WWF at the time, you know, jumping back and forth to all these promotions, at least it seemed like. But it only lasted about, what, 7 years?
It was an endless
tease. Really it.
It was always like, here comes this greatness. We never really got to drown ourselves in that, unfortunately.
So when was the first time you saw him, when we talk about memories there? Because I can recall so many memories of Brian Pillman. You know I'm a massive fan of him.
Well, again, I wasn't a big WCW guy, but I knew hints of the Hollywood Blondes at the time. And I remember, again, just the promos that he was coming in, this loose cannon. And I was like, it was exciting. It was, you know, they used to hype up their guys before they came for a long time back then. And he had his own share of problems. I made that last an even longer time. mostly to me, he was more of a promo guy than a wrestler, because he just never got to fully arrive.
The art of the character, even though he was ultra athletic, innovative, it's his character that always stood out. I discovered him when I believe I was about 16 years old. And I went back to all the old matches, Juice and Thunder Liger, of course, and so many in WCW, even going back to Stampede Wrestling. And I own his book, by the way, as well, too, Crazy Like a Fox. And also, you'll be surprised by this, I've watched his DVD about 25 times.
I wish I was surprised by that, Chris, but I know you. Of course you did.
Oh, yeah! But speaking of the loose cannon gimmick, back in 1996, it was the talk of the wrestling business, with everyone from promoters, fans, dirt sheet journalists, and the wrestlers themselves all discussing what was real and what was part of Brian's character. Again, blurring that proverbial line. And he managed to play the management of ECW, WCW, and WWF against each other, thus securing himself the first ever WWF guaranteed contract in the process. So actually, when you look at this too, highly influential from that regard, right, Corey?
Absolutely. That's if anything, Pillman was a businessman above all. All of this will paint that picture for you.
Oh, definitely. And this is the story of how the loose cannon pulled it off when it comes to individuals associated with the Attitude Era. A man often left out of that discussion is Brian Effin Pillman.
That's right, buddy. Okay, so Brian Pillman becoming the loose cannon. Ooh. Where did it all begin? Okay, so towards the end of 1995, Brian Pillman was desperately trying to stay relevant in WCW. Keep in mind, he had to compete with the likes of Macho Man Randy Savage, yeah, Sting, Ric Flair, and Hulk Hogan. He had been a popular star in the Heart Stampede Wrestling in the late 80s, had a great success elevating the light heavyweight division as Flying Brian Pillman.
Oh, yeah.
In early 90s WCW. But he was starting to stagnate with no storylines and very little airtime on television. He had some success the years previous as one half of the Hollywood Blondes with stunning Steve Austin, who were terrific.
Yes.
But due to backstage politics, their team was axed just as they were becoming popular, leaving Austin to be fired, ironically, and Brian falling back down the card. Mm. Jim Ross, in WWE's 2006 DVD release, Brian Pillman, Loose Cannon, he talked about his disappointment to the Hollywood Blondes being forced apart. It's one of those sad issues of backstage politics, insecurity, decision makers that shouldn't be decision makers making bad decisions, guys paranoid of their spot. Anytime an active wrestler is involved in that process of management or creative, it's a recipe for disaster.
And also worth noting, too, here, Corey, since Austin was experiencing a solid singles run at first, he rejected the initial idea of tagging with Pillman. He said no, but then the two quickly gelled, they started wearing matching gear, and they really emerged as one of the best tag teams of 93. And even though it was a very short run, they're one of my all-time favorite tag teams from the 90s. And it's interesting, too, because Bischoff was saying he was not a fan of tag team wrestling. So when he took over, that was about, what, 1993, 94, from an economic standpoint, he felt the cost too much pairing them together because there wasn't really any opposition to draw money with. So he was really explaining it that, hey, if I'm paying them $300,000 each or $200,000 each, that's $400,000 grouped together in the ring drawing what with who, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I'm not a business guy. Bischoff is kind of one. So, yeah, that makes sense. But I think breaking them up changes everything from now on. And so it's the butterfly effect is insane here because maybe Pillman's still alive, even if this is a breakup, you know? And maybe Austin barely remember that guy's name if they don't break up here. You know, everything's different after that.
You're right. And the weird thing, too, was that so they gelled together, they win the tag team championships together. I believe they were voted tag team of the year, I think for PWI or Wrestling Observer, one of them. And then all of a sudden they break up. So Austin's saying, wait a minute. So you put us together reluctantly, I accept. And now you're going to rip us apart? Like, this guy has become one of my best friends. We traveled together. We're loving the time together. We're gelling. Just as we're getting momentum, that's it? Sayonara?
One of the odd ideas that come with wrestling, all the inexplicable things that occur in wrestling lore.
God, and you can obviously see me through the camera, but at the same time, as you were describing the WCW politics, I was over here with a not-so-shocked look on my face. That seems to be the problem that held so many people back, including Brian and Steve Austin.
Yeah, they're not alone in that department, if that's for sure.
Certainly not. So with a year left on his contract, or just under that, and with back injuries and really a growing family, I believe he had about 6 children as well, which not a lot of people tend to remember, to look after, Brian started to look into the future. So he started to think, well, I need to make some money, and I need to start making main event money. I need to provide for my family, put some food on the table. So Steve Austin spoke about this on his podcast. He said Brian knew the kids at the house, well, he had them there, that was always at the forefront of his mind, being able to take care of the kids and pay all the bills. He knew his contract was coming up, and he was trying to find a way to increase his value. So to take that to the next level, he actually sought out Eric Bischoff on how he can improve his place in the company. And he'd been told because of that raspy voice, and again, that's due to over 30 throat surgeries, I believe even more than that as a child to remove cancerous polyps, he never really could be a believable babyface, at least in the eyes of Eric Bischoff, I should say. And due to his smaller size, he'd never be a believable powerhouse heel. So Brian had to come up with a unique persona that would stand out from the rest of the roster. Again, he can be a smaller guy, but he can still have a big bite, so to speak. So Bischoff stated in the 11th episode, very specific, of the 83 Weeks podcast, Brian was very proactive and constructive in his approach to it. This is where he and I started talking about what to do with his character and how to utilize him in a different way. Bischoff on Pillman's Loose Cannon DVD back in 2006, he had this to say, Brian and I talked about the evolution of his character, turning into more of an unpredictable Loose Cannon as we've come to know. That was all Brian. It was something that I liked because it was different. Oftentimes, when you try to be better than somebody else, you copy them. The magic with Brian is that he found a character that was so different than everybody else, it was easy for that character to stand out. I have to say, I mean, coming up with an original character in pro wrestling and demanding attention with that is the holy grail of pro wrestling. And in 1995, Pillman's character was so far ahead of his time. Would you agree, Corey?
Completely. I think the comparison here would be like it's almost a different approach to having a character. It's like method acting.
Yeah.
Like he's like the Marlon Brando. He's internalized all of his characteristics and they're releasing from him instead of externalizing. And, much like Doink or Dink or the rest of the other guys in the federations there at the time, he's the opposite. Everything's coming from within. It's not a circus.
No, that's true. And back in 1995, too, and you've actually watched this recently, we'll talk about it later, that was like the Dungeon of Doom era as well with Hulk Hogan. And this water is not hot.
Oh, God. I've watched that 12 times this week. I love it. It's actually the name of one of my group chats right now.
Really?
That is classic.
The water is not hot? That's amazing.
Exclaiming the water is not hot is when it's made a sizzle sound is, what is that? What's happening?
There's no Hulkamaniacs here.
That's incredible. Yeah, Dungeon of Doom. We go with RoboCop as a wrestler and Kamala and, all so many things. And we are recording this in the middle, in the very unique position of middle of WrestleMania 36.
So, yes.
And I'm on the side of that Undertaker. AJ Styles' Boneyard match was silly beyond all belief, but you look at the Dungeon of Doom and, good God, we are far from the silliest thing that's ever happened in wrestling at this point.
Yeah.
The Dungeon was silly.
Yeah, the Dungeon of Doom has to take the cake, at least with that. Of course, they had the Yeti as part of it. The man famously wrapped in toilet paper, which at this period of time is sought after. It's valuable like gold.
Absolutely. It's kind of like the hilarious House of Frankenstein.
Yes.
Dungeon, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Which, a special place in my heart.
Yeah, so you know what? Over the top, if you can take off your serious cap for a moment, such as the Boneyard match, I look at that as a C-level horror movie, and I highly enjoyed it for that very reason. It was entertaining, but at the same time, you know it's not going to be highly serious, even though it was cinematic, and let's be honest as well, too, we won't go too far into left field here, but Broken Matt Hardy deserves some credit for that as well, too. He laid the foundation for some of these matches with Ultimate Deletion and so many others.
Yeah, I wish it remained foundation, personally, and an unutilized foundation, but that's different strokes for different folks, I guess.
So back to Brian Pillman, the character on air would blur the lines between reality and kayfabe, causing fans to question what was staged and which was the wrestlers going off script, which I love. That's the quote-unquote worked shoot, so to speak. So, which takes quite a bit of commitment, as you can imagine. The first instance of this was on WCW's Clash of Champions 1996. You've watched this in a match with Eddie Guerrero. A really solid match. Two great workers, because many tend to forget Brian Pillman as Flying Brian was a remarkable worker. You look at his matches he had there against Juice and Thunder Liger and so many others. Ric Flair wanted to put him over. And here with Eddie Guerrero, he was still in the prime of his career. So what happened here was that he was playing the coward in the match, running from Guerrero, and he yanked commentator Tony Schiavone's headset off. But then later, he would return to rip Bobby Heenan's jacket off. Heenan had ongoing neck problems, of course, at this point. He was insisting no wrestlers ever touch him at ringside, and this was not planned to be part of the show, so he instantly stood up and he shouted, "What the F are you doing?" And that was live on pay-per-view. I've gone back and seen it. I was like, oh my God, you got to be so embarrassed. He picked up his jacket. He walked backstage. Brian later apologized to Heenan. But again, this was the beginning of the act of starting to really blur the lines between scripted and reality, a work and a shoot. Do you recall this moment? Because I've watched it probably about a dozen times, and I really feel bad for Bobby here.
Yeah, I do. It's painful to watch you because everyone respects the brain, and you just look like he's hurt almost. He's like physically and kind of like, why would you do that to me? You know?
Also, he knows that he screwed up too. Like, he knows, like, I said something I shouldn't have.
Yeah.
I didn't really know what was going on.
If you could break Bobby the Brain Heenan, then you've really done your stuff. You've done your work.
No kidding. And then he had somewhat of a nonchalant, like his explanation, he was saying it was a fan, but was it? And all of that as well, too. Like, I thought it was a fan doing that. But at the same time, the fan would actually have to jump over the guardrail, if you recall, and grab it. Yeah. So highly unlikely.
Yeah, you might notice that. All right, and then comes Brian Pillman versus the Booker Man.
Booker Man, yes.
Okay, so by this point, active wrestler Kevin Sullivan was now the head booker for WCW. Bischoff and Pillman devised a worked shoot feud consisting of Pillman and Sullivan fighting and presenting it to the fans and wrestlers alike as legitimate. The seeds of the feud were planted behind the scenes when Pillman, in an on-air promo, made a subtle hint to his stablemate Chris Benoit and Sullivan's wife, Nancy, having a potential affair. In reality, she would leave Sullivan for Benoit the very next year. This had the locker room buzzing with rumors that there was tension between Pillman and Sullivan, which would be accentuated further when Eric Bischoff called a locker room meeting and was going over some of the new rules for the talent. Pillman screamed out, "Does this go for the Booker Man too?"
Oof. I would love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
Absolutely. This disrespect for the new Booker continued in the ring on an episode of Nitro, where after Sullivan called Pillman disrespectful, they got into a fight where they were tearing at each other, with Sullivan appearing to viciously go for Pillman's eyes. The announcers and referees were not clued into what would happen, and by all accounts, only Sullivan, Bischoff, and Pillman knew about the angle. For a week or so, no one else in the wrestling business had any idea what had happened, and it wasn't until the next Nitro, when Sullivan cut a promo on Pillman, that people started to suspect it was all part of the plan. But it still had a lot of wrestlers backstage fooled, which is saying a lot, actually, at that time. So Sullivan and Pillman headed into the next pay-per-view, Super Brawl 6.
You've seen this many times recently.
Oh, nasty. That was a rough 4 hours of my life.
Oh.
To battle in an I respect you strap match, essentially an I quit match, where you have to make your opponent announce their respect for you in order to win the match.
What a horrible gimmick for the match, though, too. So all of a sudden you're like locked in a sharpshooter. You're supposed to just yell like, I respect you. Ring the bell.
I want you to know if we had that match, I would lose, buddy.
Oh, you are too kind. I'm over here blushing.
I respect you. It would have lasted shorter than this match did.
This was such a blip on the radar, too. I remember when I watched it for the first time and I had heard so much about it, I thought, okay, so is this really, you know, like a minute, like a minute 30? Yeah. Is it? It was. It was like no time at all. They make their entrances. It's just done.
Yeah. And that's a monumental event to happen in 1 minute and be like, okay, that's it. But again, left its mark.
Yeah.
In the shoot timeline, the history of WCW 1996, Kevin Sullivan remembers how Brian's idea was getting everyone talking. Mm-hmm. While this was happening, I'd have guys coming up to me saying, this Pillman is an asshole. Please beat the shit out of him.
Jeez.
2 minutes later, I'd see him round the corner saying the same thing to Pillman about me. One of the biggest compliments I ever got in my life was when Kevin Nash was up there in WWE. He said a bunch of them bought the pay-per-view to see the shoot, and he said they bought it as a shoot.
Mm.
Pillman's idea was working. People in other wrestling companies were taking notice of him, and he had catapulted himself up the card with his loose cannon gimmick. The Super Brawl 6 only lasted mere moments. There was some tussling around and aggressive strap shots before Pillman grabbed the microphone from the referee, looked at Sullivan, and said, I respect you, Booker Man.
I love the way he says it, too. He's like, I respect you, Booker Man.
Yeah. The first time wrestling bookers had ever been mentioned on air. Wow. And I wonder if people, maybe it worked as a loose gimmick for the fans too. They probably just thought he was referring to like Booker T or something and getting them confused.
It's like, are they going to feud? What's going on here? I'm unsure.
But yeah. He's just so confused and crazy and off the cuff that he thinks it's Booker T. He then stormed backstage, flipping off the fans, and tried to leave the arena. Still in the ring, no one knew what was going on apart from Sullivan. The commentators were trying to make the best of it, but believe Pillman had actually broken character, and Arn Anderson came out in non-wrestling gear to have an impromptu match in order to save the show.
He was like in short shorts, by the way, too.
Yeah, like that looked real. Like I know that this is all set up, but like this all, you can watch this 12 times and everyone looks pretty confused, like genuinely. Okay, now what do we do? Like, yeah, let's save the day somehow.
You're right. You would think that they just said, just go out there, Arn, go fix this.
Yeah, in your shorts. Yeah. Backstage and away from the cameras, Eric Bischoff fired Brian Pillman to an audience of just other wrestlers, which is amazing, before Brian left the building. WCW locker room thought Brian had been fired for real. Of course they did. And off he left for greener pastures, while secretly still on the payroll. Mm. Bischoff stated in the Loose Cannon DVD that Brian's idea was, let me do my thing so that when I come back, I'll have a little more shine on me.
Wow. What? So to me, first of all, I mean, this essentially plays out like a movie script, right? You've been an actor for quite some time. This is like a real life movie script. And from the brilliant mind of Brian Pillman, without any additional insight, would you believe that this was a shoot? Because I mean, again, based on what you said and me watching it too, if I did not have the internet to rely on and read all about this, I would think, okay, this guy's legitimately crazy. He's fired. Like, what is he doing here?
It's like all the people that think the Montreal Screwjob, despite all information,
yeah,
was a shoot. I feel like they're saying this is a shoot, but it wasn't. Because, like, it's just, it looks so, it's so just like raw and cagey and just off the cuff. It just like looks like this just happened. It looks like a scramble for organization, and yeah, I don't know. I'm still not convinced.
But if you're Eric Bischoff, this is what always perplexed me. If you're Eric Bischoff, why would you ever let him go and just take his word for it? Like, hey, you're still on the payroll, but go off to ECW and other places and we'll bring you back. Like, I would not trust that, especially at a time when people were jumping ship.
Of course, that's not when you're doing that, that's for sure.
Really bizarre. And of course, as I alluded to, he did go to ECW, and that's where he became Brian Effin Pillman. So full disclosure, Corey, I was a big ECW fan. Not necessarily of the whole hardcore aspect, but just the gimmicks, the storyline, some of the incredible matches there. And this is one of my all-time favorite moments in the history of the promotion. I rewatch this promo at least every couple of months. That's how much I love it.
Holy wow. All right.
It's amazing because 6 days later, after he's, you know, quote unquote released, he's still on the payroll again with WCW. 6 days after this, he's in the famous ECW arena. Yes, the bingo hall for ECW CyberSlam 96. Joey Styles is in the middle of the ring announcing the show. The lights go out. I'm sure you recall this moment. I remember it vividly. When they come back on, standing in the ring, holding the cane. Just infamous. You could put that on a t-shirt. The Loose Cannon, Brian Pillman. He has that leather vest on. He's got the cane. And then, of course, there's the sign, Pillman, don't work me. I love that as well, too. That just adds to the whole unpredictability and allure of this character, right?
Yeah, and just kind of already from that point, his appeal to maybe internet fans, that people are already carrying signs and they're aware. We're getting the winks to the internet at this point.
Yeah, and what I love about this, too, it's one of the greatest worked shoot interviews of all time. So as many, of course, start pointing to CM Punk's pipe bomb, which was fantastic. These sort of promos were the original pipe bombs. Also, Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was Steve Austin at the time, who was released, came over to ECW. He had a very infamous one as well, too, where his was a pipe bomb. So what happened here is Pillman, of course, he's babyface. He starts off that way. He starts to conduct a promo where he, you know, quickly starts ripping on Eric Bischoff, calls him Eric Jerkoff, and how he was recently fired from WCW. But then, you know, he's starting to swear quite a bit. And it's weird because many start to look at ECW and think that was par for the course. It actually wasn't. So the fact that he was swearing was a little bit groundbreaking. And he had the WCW hating Philadelphia fans just loving this, eating out the palm of his hand. And then before he turns on the crowd, referring to them as smart marks, Eric Bischoff is every one of these mother effing smart marks rolled up into one giant piece of shit. That's what he screams as he's right near the turnbuckle. And it's funny, too, because they don't really catch on at that point. If you keep rewatching it back, they're probably thinking, is this like a compliment? But then again, just like that Booker Man comment, you know, that's the first time we've ever heard smart marks used, because that was an insider term for, you know, really knowledgeable fans. And that had never been mentioned in the ring or on television at the time, right?
There's three guys in that audience that are like, I get that. He's talking to me.
And there's a couple parts that always stand out to me. You know, again, with the long history of swearing, it was great and groundbreaking. But then he starts mocking them. He says, a mark is a guy who believes that OJ didn't do it.
Big insult at the time.
It was. So I love that. And then I think he has the one, too, where they spend their last few dollars on crack cocaine. He keeps going on and on. But then Steve Austin really talks about the effectiveness of this promo. And again, coming from Steve Austin, a big compliment, how Brian had the crowd eating out of the palm of his hand. He said this, everybody knew he got fired. And he starts playing to them and they're taking him as a babyface. Then he gives them that pause in the beginning. He lets them cheer after he calls Bischoff the jerk off. Then he starts roping them. And he's all about to crap all over them. The crowd tries to take the interview over by doing the chant. That doesn't work. He keeps his low, gravelly voice. And then he puts the hammer down. He gets over the fact that he's Brian Effin Pillman. In one promo, he is over. It's unbelievable when you go back and watch it. The fact that in a promo, you could just turn on them to the point where it's like, get this guy out of here. I don't want to see him anymore.
Absolutely. That's unique to him.
Very much so. So he continued to insult the fans, and then he claimed the only appropriate thing for Brian Pillman to do is yank out Mike Johnson and piss in this hellhole, which, by the way, he did not do. He did not expose himself. I've read on various forums well over the years of people that were there, they said, yes, he did yank it and started urinating, which is not true. Even Joey Styles actually confirmed this to say, I was right there with him. He did not do that.
Hyperbole in wrestling? Impossible.
Revisionist history. And it's at this point, too, this is really the icing on the cake, Corey. ECW bosses Paul Heyman, Todd Gordon, they come out claiming, this isn't part of the deal, Brian. This isn't part of the deal. And then, of course, Brian attacks a planted fan. He calls Heyman Booker Man, and he's run off by ECW wrestler Shane Douglas. So once again, the wrestling world explodes, and everybody's talking about whether Brian was working the boys yet again, or was this all part of the plan? So who knows for sure, but he continued his ECW run, feuding with Shane Douglas, interrupting matches, cutting these insane promos, referring to the bookers as men with pencils. In fact, he actually fought with a giant pencil in reference to this, which is just so weird. But at the same time, what many tend to forget, Corey, is that he generated all of this buzz. He never wrestled one match in ECW. That is virtually unheard of.
That's a businessman. That's again, what's unique to this is the beginning where the internet is utilized to be your strength in wrestling, which now it's arguably wrestling is an internet company or an internet business.
Yeah, it is.
It's just the insiders are everywhere and people know more than other people because they've read this article, and he's using that already at this point, and no one else is doing that whatsoever.
And what I love too is that even though the people think they know, they cannot confirm it and they do not know for sure. Only he does.
Right. And who's he going to ask? Who's the audience going to ask? Guy beside him? Did he say Mark? Am I a Mark? They don't know. They don't think anyone else knows what's happening here.
Paul Heyman, can you please define what a Mark is? I want to know if I fall into this category or not.
I like to think I'm a Mark. Am I a Mark? He's talking right to me. All right. So Brian Pillman, genius or madman?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Question. A little bit of both. Most madmen are geniuses.
Yes, they are.
To make the loose cannon gimmick continue to work, Brian realized he'd have to keep everyone guessing and live the gimmick 24/7. Oh,
commitment.
That may have been a little more than necessary. Yeah. But Pillman realized that to keep the buzz going and have people talking, he would have to start convincing the locker room he'd gone crazy too.
Oh, man.
Possibly also overcompensation. But
yeah, I think so.
Sure. Jericho recalls in his highly recommended autobiography, A Lion's Tale, he still kept showing up in the crowd at WCW events, causing disturbances on live TV, and leading the fans and everyone in the company to think he lost his marbles. But it wasn't just for the shows. He was playing crazy all the time. He'd shown up in ECW to continue the elaborate work and perfect his loony act. He was also doing an excellent job of convincing everyone that he'd lost it. He'd shown up at the arena that day with his pants falling down from not having a belt. He went around to everyone in the dressing room asking them if they had an extra belt. Who doesn't? And ended up settling on a piece of twine.
Oh, my God.
Then out in the ring, the Sandman hit a jobber with his trademark kendo stick, knocking the guy loopy. The guy was obviously going to be fine, but that didn't stop Pillman from running around the dressing room, jumping up and down and screaming like a crack-addicted monkey in his gravelly voice. Call 911, call 911, for the love of Christ, somebody call 911. Now that's one of his crazier, that like everyone up back there must be like, we do this every day. What are you talking about?
They must have been like, you are on drugs or something. If you're that exposed to this, or this is so new to you that you've never seen somebody get hit by a kendo stick, what are you doing in this business?
Yeah. ECW, remember? He was completely overreacting as if the guy had been beheaded. But he wouldn't stop and was making everyone in the room very uncomfortable. When right in the middle of his tirade with nobody looking, he gave me a wink. I thought, that guy is a genius. He's working everybody.
Wow. He would do that with people that he liked. I've heard that many, many occasions that he would give that little wink. And it's like, wow, I have this pertinent information now. Everybody thinks that he's legitimately insane, but I know this is part of the act.
Yeah, a small assembly of people.
No kidding. Mick Foley, I believe he famously told this story. It may even be in the DVD. That's one part I actually don't recall. It's been a little while since I've watched it, but
it is in the DVD. Yeah.
Good. So he's noted. He wanted to know if it was a work or not, but he figured Pillman would have told him either way. So he's a little bit insulted at the same time.
He looks hurt.
Yeah. Like I figured he would tell me, but instead here I am, Cactus Jack, sitting back here thinking, Brian, I'm right here, buddy.
Yeah, why don't you tell me you weren't crazy? I would have loved that information.
So it was also around this time that Brian Pillman had come up with various stunts that he could perform in order to raise his profile and garner attention outside of the wrestling world. And one of his ideas was to actually run onto the field at the Super Bowl and chain himself naked to the goalpost. It's actually true. Kevin Sullivan said on Vince Russo's podcast, bro, he remembers that Brian was pitching the idea. Remember when Cincinnati went to the Super Bowl? Nobody really does. He came to me and said, I'm going to do something that's going to shock the wrestling world. Not the Shockmaster, though. During the game, when the ball's on the other end, I'm going to run out on the field with a chain, strip naked, and lock myself to the goalpost with six chains. Even if they stayed away from it, you knew it was going to make the front page. They would have to put him away in observation for 90 days, but he was willing to do it. Kevin Sullivan stressed, that's how far out he was thinking. That's insane.
Yeah, so that's overcompensation maybe a little bit again.
Also, to show you how big of a Pillman mark I am, is that I'm not a big football guy, but I would actually own a Cincinnati Bengals 97 Pillman jersey, because that was his number when he played for the Cincinnati Bengals. That's the only one I ever want to own. I know the Bengals are not a good team, but it was Pillman's team, so I have love for them.
If we ever get a Christmas again, I'll make sure that's on my list of gifts for you, pal.
Christmas is canceled this year. So as we're looking at this, could you imagine the possible ramifications of this actually occurring if Brian Pillman did this?
Wrestling will always do anything for a crossover event to get in the actual public eye.
Yeah.
So, of course, they would have loved that. But again, this is like, what, 5 years before Nipplegate, you know, before Janet Jackson revealed the old nipple at a different Super Bowl.
Oh, yes.
I'm pretty sure a dick would have gone over probably worse.
Oh, that would have been bad. Imagine the sponsors. Snickers wants nothing to do with the Super Bowl anymore after this.
Yeah, no more Slim Jims. So I wonder. Good God, I wish it happened.
What a what-if scenario.
All the what-ifs. It was around this time when Brian first met WWF chairman Vince McMahon. There was a NAPTE, NAPTE conference in Las Vegas, in which representatives from both WCW and WWF attend, along with many people from the television industry. Brian broke in by borrowing Dave Meltzer's press pass and went straight to McMahon and Jim Ross to cause a scene.
And Dave Meltzer, is he not held accountable for this? Actually, they were friends, and that's where Dave got a lot of his information from, was Brian directly, actually.
Yeah, do you know if Meltzer got any repercussions from this at all?
Don't think so. I mean, he was still covering the WWF at the time, so maybe they didn't care. Maybe it was a blessing because they really captured his attention.
Yeah, it worked out, I guess. Austin recalls Brian was a super smart guy. He was at a NAPTE convention one night, and that one day, whatever it was in Vegas, he goes up and starts taking pictures with Vince and taking pictures of Vince, and right before he leaves, he's making this big, loud production about it. Totally just crashes the party. That's amazing. I've been there. And he goes to shake Jim Ross's hand, and he gets in his ear, and he goes, "It's a work," which means Jim is now in the fistful of five. So he goes out, and Jim relays the message to Vince because Vince doesn't know what's going on, and Jim says to Vince, "You've been worked." And that's what got in Vince's mind, what kind of guy this was. What he was doing was creating this loose cannon character.
He worked me. Damn it, he worked me, pal.
I was waiting for that. And just going further and further out there. And then doing the Bookerman thing. He was taking on Kevin Sullivan at that one pay-per-view event. He was basically able to extricate himself from his WCW contract. And it appears every wrestler from this era has a story about how crazy Pillman was. And yet it's only a few who mention his intelligence and knowledge when it came to the business.
No kidding. Really, it's on full display.
Yeah, that's the prevailing message I'm getting here. Steve Austin often recalls how when driving together from town to town, Brian would often be sat in the back reading vocabulary books or wrestling history books in order to gain more knowledge and better his promos and in-ring work. He's well known for calling other wrestlers in the middle of the night to ask them about choices they made in the ring, or studying tapes of Terry Funk or Bruiser Brody and even serial killers in order to get the maniacal cadence and delivery on point in his interviews, which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Ross recalled he became so learned beyond his years. He would observe this information like a sponge. Mm. Brian became a wrestling historian.
That's amazing. And another book that he was big into, and I recall this, was Hooker by Lou Thesz. Jim has noted in the past that this was essentially his Bible. He would keep this with him all the time. He knew it word for word. He was obviously a very passionate and creative man, as we can see. And again, studying the greats such as Terry Funk and Bruiser Brody is obviously a testament to his intelligence too.
Yeah, I mean, Brody really, that's a predecessor, I guess, for this kind of deal, I guess.
He would have to be number one on that list. When you think about people who played convincing the most crazy, I'd have to say Bruiser Brody. And again, as you saw in Dark Side of the Ring, his wife would say he would leave And again, it was my husband. I saw it, but then I saw it would just flip like a switch, and he was Bruiser Brody. Right. And she never met Bruiser Brody, she said.
Right. Some people say that wrestlers are actually the greatest actors in the world because you're playing this role and you don't get a second take it, and you're living it, which is, I mean, maybe Daniel Day-Lewis and a few others, but that's not generally how it goes.
We're live, pal. It's true, though, right? I mean, if you're on a stage and it's live, as they say, or again, like Monday Night Raw, SmackDown, any of these shows, AEW, when you're out there and you're performing in front of a live audience, you have one take, you screw up. Also from there, how do you cover it? How do you make up for it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's happened a few times. Like Sid, when Sid screws up his promo.
We're live, pal. So Brian Pillman would also play all sides, but it was also when WCW would start to order him to come back from ECW that Pillman would put his real genius masterwork into action. It's time to take over the world. So during his time in ECW, Brian Pillman was still technically employed by WCW. I mentioned that earlier in a working agreement with Bischoff that had been secretly made with ECW owner Paul Heyman. Now, keep in mind, Eric and Paul did not like each other at this time, especially Paul. He would say, "You're stealing all my talent. I don't like you." But people backstage were starting to suspect that Pillman may not be the free agent that he'd be claiming to be. So Pillman used this essentially to convince Eric Bischoff to give him legitimate termination papers, which I think stupidly Bischoff agreed in order to make the whole angle seem more real, more legitimate to the backstage talent. And so Brian was effectively released from his WCW contract. Are you kidding me? Why would you do that?
Incredible. He out-businessed Eric.
No kidding.
That's what happened.
So even Eric Bischoff was saying on the DVD, "I'm not sure if he was working me or if we were working everybody else." Now, this is not necessarily covered in the article, but Eric Bischoff did say that when he was unhappy in WWF, he would call Eric Bischoff from time to time and really talk about, "Maybe I could come back. Maybe we could do it again." And Eric would always take his call, apparently.
That's, I wish it, I'm happy it never happened, really.
Yeah, me too. I think that he was fine in WWF. We will get to that shortly. So Brian now had his legitimate documents claiming that he was no longer employed by WCW, and he was appearing on ECW Weekly TV despite the fact that he was on WCW payroll. Now, he took these documents to WWF offices and started negotiating with Vince McMahon for a WWF contract. So he made himself a hot commodity. In just a few months, he was now playing with the three biggest wrestling companies of the 90s, really against each other, in order to leverage himself into a big money contract. And he'd been constantly told he would never get one. Yet he was working himself into this. It's absolutely incredible.
That's brilliant. He had no business background. How did he pull this off?
One of my favorite, I don't know, but I can't think of anybody else that would have the business savvy and just be conniving enough and ruthless enough to do it. And daring too, because he could be blackballed from all three companies, right?
He could have lost all three easily.
Yeah, and then they say, "Go to the alternative." He's like, "There are no other alternatives." It's not like the indie scene was booming at that place, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what would happen here is WCW, again, this is also a testament to his business savvy. WCW would still order him to return from ECW due to being on their payroll. So at this time, ECW was promoting Brian Pillman in the hotline, if you recall this. So that's where you could call in and talk to him. And actually, what he would do is he would usually shoot on the people calling or act unpredictably. Even sometimes he would talk really slow because it was per minute. So he'd be like, "I'm Brian Pillman." Like, I'm not joking. I heard these stories personally from people on forums that, because I was super inquisitive. I was asking people, like, "No, I called and this is what happened." So
you never called,
Chris? No, never did.
How you're the mark. How'd that not happen?
Because my parents would have booted me out of the house. That's why. They saw that and they're like, what is this? What is this garbage? You're calling the Brian Pillman hotline? Is this drugs, pills?
Yeah, you're right. I guess I wonder what came up on the bill.
Corey, I would have been like 10 years old at the time too. I was definitely not like 10 or 11. I was not daring enough to do that at the time. I did not want to be completely thrown out. So WCW brings
him back.
We
didn't have our own phones back then.
That's either, also so true, too. I was actually on the landline and, you pick it up and so, yeah. And hey, back in those days, if you got in trouble at school, I would just purposely take the phone off the hook or leave it on. I'm like, they're never going to get through. My parents will never hear this phone call.
So many ways to avoid things back then.
No, there were. Not anymore, because now they can email you, text you. They can do everything under the sun. So either way, WCW brings him back. He's featured in crowd shots, acting like a wild man. Chris Jericho noted this, holding a sign promoting his hotline. So what's insane is he establishes his hotline in ECW. He's promoting it, and apparently he made a very respectable amount of money from this venture. It was 900-288-PILL was the number. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's the marks. There's the marks. That's his audience. He was going right for the internet people, and he was talking right to them, so they wanted to talk back, right? It's business.
I just love how he shoots on them, too. So they call, and they're like, "Hey, Brian, I'm a big fan. I don't need you. Shut up."
People are paying money for that kind of response.
Yeah, and they're over there going, "Oh, my God, put it on speaker. I can't wait."
I mean, I would have done the same thing.
Oh, same. I would have been insulted if he did not insult me.
I would call it right now if it was an option.
So from that, we have Brian now back on WCW TV. And again, also showing his business savvy here. And we've seen this match. I'm sure we will discuss it at a later date. Hulk Hogan started to notice the impact that Brian was having. So he decided he wanted to face Brian and get a little bit of the spotlight back on himself. So at the time, Hulk and Randy Savage were teaming to take on 8 opponents. You heard that right, in a doomsday cage match. So adding Brian Pillman would actually make it a 9-on-2 handicap match. Hogan would win by pinning Brian with the leg drop, but wisely, Pillman told management he couldn't participate due to doctors telling him he would require another throat surgery within a year. So given that this was one of the worst matches of all time, Pillman clearly escaped disaster and a burial, too.
Yeah, and the foresight is insane because, honestly, when you hear of that match, seems and looks interesting. Looks like, oh, it's a little swerve. That'll be interesting, but it was terrible for sure. Nothing. It was just horrible. Yeah. And given wrestling's penchant for burying, especially WCW's penchant for burying, the foresight in knowing that just becoming another cog in the Hogan machine was not for him and would have just ended all the momentum was, again, businessman and foresight. That a boy.
And Dave Meltzer further elaborated on this. It was in an October 2006 edition of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. When he got the buzz that Hogan wanted him in the match, he scheduled surgery. So it wasn't even the doctors telling him. He's like, I'm just going to schedule surgery. So the surgery was real. And at some point over the next couple of months, he was going to need it. But this was a surgery to avoid Hogan burying him. And his feeling was just wrestling a match in WCW, let alone a pay-per-view, and being a ping pong ball for Hogan would kill his gimmick. And then in actuality, he stressed to me, this is what Dave Meltzer was saying, that he knew that this match was going to be near the top of every list of the worst matches in the history of the industry. So he knew it.
Yeah. Like, how did he know? And for anyone to try to escape Hogan in their wrestling career is kind of unheard of anyway. And to go to those lengths to do it.
They should have all pulled out. Like, Ric Flair should have been like, my knee's bugging me. I'm out, too.
Yeah. Actually, that huge cage with only 2 guys would have been pretty awesome, actually.
Hogan and Savage are like, I guess we're wrestling each other. That's all that we have left.
Yeah, that was a really weird match.
It was bizarre. So, like, as you noted, it looked good on paper, but the execution was piss poor.
Yeah, execution and burial, big WCW staples of failure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So negotiating with the WWF, Brian had been having contract negotiations, meeting with the WWF, now WWE, by showing them his WCW termination papers. And now Eric Bischoff, knowing Pillman's contract would legitimately run out in the coming weeks, started to try to negotiate a new contract with Brian to capitalize on the storylines he'd already originally helped conceive. At the height of the Monday Night Wars, Brian had both WWF and WCW trying to outbid each other in order to bring the loose cannon to their company. Meltzer later wrote, Bischoff lowballed Pillman in the early negotiations, but when he realized McMahon was making a serious play and offering guaranteed money, believed to be around $250,000 to $300,000 downside with the potential of more if he could work on top. McMahon had only offered guaranteed money to a handful of wrestlers in history at this point, so Bischoff upped his offer to somewhere in the $400,000 range. And he'd worked the system and everyone in the system and got an offer nearly double what he had been making. But he was already starting to morph into the character in a bad way.
Oh,
so
did you ever hear the story as well, too, about how I think this may have been Bill Watts correct me if I'm wrong, but it may have been Bill Watts that said, listen, I'm coming in, I'm slashing budgets at the time. So you can make what you're making, but you're going to lose every single match. Or you can take a pay cut and I can push you. And he's like, well, I don't care. I'll make the money and lose every match.
Oof. That's a interesting proposal. Not much of one, actually.
I probably would just lose and take the money and say, well, I guess I'll just laugh to the bank as I get pinned 1-2-3 every night.
So Pillman was pretty, he was aiming for the stars, though, right?
He was, yes.
Yeah. Here was a match. This is Paul Heyman. This is where it all switches over. Ooh. Paul Heyman says, here was a man that was the talk of all three promotions and about to make the biggest money in his career, feed his family, make enough in a couple of years to really stock away a retirement. And then, bam.
That was it.
Bam. That was it. The wreck. This is so sad. Because you can't even pretend that this didn't change everything, right?
It changes the entire direction of his career, essentially, right? Because after this, he was never the same. And we've seen that with many wrestlers in the past, too.
Yeah, it's just a fact. The wreck. Brian had been living the loose cannon gimmick hard since its original inception. He'd often binge, staying up for days, and was becoming somewhat strung out. Mm. In April 1996, Brian had fallen asleep at the wheel and driving his recently bought Humvee one night. He flipped the Humvee and was thrown over 40 feet from the car. His face was an unrecognizable mess, and his foot had been snapped back 180 degrees. I hate reading that. And now pointed in the wrong direction. Blah. In the middle of his contract negotiations, Brian had potentially hurt himself so badly, he may never wrestle again. Mm. Heyman would say that wreck just tore him up and he was just consumed with guilt over it. One little mistake, eh?
Yeah.
He blamed himself for crashing his car, Dave Meltzer explained in his newsletter, and ruining everything he worked for. Plus, now he thought his career was over as well. First thing he did was lie to everyone, including me. He said as bad off as he was, the doctor said he would be able to wrestle and after healing his ankle would be 100%. He even said since it had been damaged for a decade that it would actually be stronger after the surgery than it had been before. And to his shock, both McMahon and Bischoff were still after him.
Man.
And he was downplaying the long-term effects to both of them. In the end, McMahon hired him because Bischoff, not fully trusting whether Pillman really was going to make a full recovery, offered more money but wouldn't eliminate the standard 90-day termination cycle in the multi-year contract. When Bischoff wouldn't budge on that point, that was the difference maker.
This reminds me a lot of the motorcycle crash that occurred with Kerry Von Erich, by the way. And he was never quite the same after that. And he still worked at a high level. And I'm still to this day uncertain how he was able to do that physically. And same with Brian. The fact that he could even wrestle again based on what we just heard, it's remarkable and it's crazy at the same time.
There's a lot of those in wrestling history. We just talked about Lex a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to get his arm amputated.
And
then it became
bad.
His weapon. Yeah.
Or Brutus. So, remember, Brutus, his face caved in as well. Brother Brutai.
He wins. He wins that round. Ugh,
but it's definitely this big what-if question. I mean, you look at a couple here. What if he accepted to go back to WCW? His career probably would have been nothing more than a placeholder, really. He would have never been utilized. You look at the long history of people undersized, at least in the eyes of WCW, that never really went anywhere, right? But also, if he had never flipped that Humvee, and we still had the old fly-in Brian, because we've watched him in the early 90s, and we saw him in a very innovative style, by the way, too, you know, leaping off the top rope and landing a clothesline. I mean, he was way ahead of his time physically, too.
Yeah, you want to lie to yourself and be like, oh, the car accident, he overcame it, but he definitely never did, and nothing was the same after that. And again, yeah, you're right. WCW would have buried him.
Yeah.
He probably would have been, everyone was getting sucked up into the Dungeon of Doom. He would have been joining the Yeti and RoboCop. And yeah, it would have been a waste.
It's not the that, loose cannon
not that in
the
end,
Yeti.
It wasn't a waste.
Oh, God. So we get to the final years. This is actually tough for me to go through as well, too. But Brian Pillman went to WWF and he was used as an on-air personality for most of the year with Jim Ross pushing him into a commentary role. But Brian's heart was in wrestling, as Jim would say. Personally, I felt his run as a commentator was highly underappreciated. He was on Shotgun Saturday Night for the most part, and given his physical limitations, at least in hindsight, I would have stayed there or acted as a full-time manager. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, he was great as commentary, I think, but, you know, you can't change a guy's heart. He'd made it that far.
No, and I mean, he overcame obstacles his entire career. You think about it, undersized, and he makes the cut for the Cincinnati Bengals. You see his football career, all the throat surgeries, WCW, you name it. He's done it. So he thought, I can do it here too. So he rushes back from the injury, resulting in the need for more surgeries. And again, what else happens there? As we know, a dependency on painkillers. As Jim Ross explained, I truly believe the Brian situation was that he was going to do this wrestling thing no matter what. And that's what he did, no matter what. I can't believe the pain. I can't fathom how much pain he was in on a daily basis. And it's absolutely true, especially as you painted that picture of flipping the Humvee and the ankle 180 degrees in the wrong direction. How could he do this again?
I don't go to work if I have a migraine, so I don't know. I have no idea. Different humans, me and Pillman.
No kidding. So Brian continued to push the envelope in his WWF career, and he blurred the lines of reality and kayfabe. He would show up on Raw demanding more money from Vince McMahon than an on-air announcer role and not publicly known as the owner of the company. Brett did this as well, too. And then famous, yes, we know this one, Pillman's Got a Gun, that angle, with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Stone Cold goes to his house, he pulls the gun, and nearly got them kicked off of the USA Network at that point. But his in-ring work had been greatly diminished due to the injuries, as we know. And then, of course, there was that love triangle storyline between his ex-girlfriend, by the way, and that was legit, Terry Reynolds, and her then-husband, Goldust.
Yeesh. A lot of low-hanging fruit in the Attitude Era, which is not always my favorite. Those two angles were a little, I don't know. Those are the attributes of the Attitude Era that I kind of shake my head at. But
yeah, Pillman's Got a Gun was groundbreaking, but maybe for all the wrong reasons. I mean, there was a great feud between Stone Cold and him, and of course the Pillmanizer, which is where you stick the chair between the ankle and the leg, and then you stomp it from the middle or top rope. But also worth noting, though, too, and this is not in the article, but you and I were a huge fan of this faction. He joined the Hart Foundation as the only member not related to the family. Of course, the ties to Stampede Wrestling.
Yeah, I think that to me was the standout from his time there for me, just in terms of that remained royalty. It still is royalty. And again, sad that you look at that assembly and Brett is the only one standing. Still.
God, that's one of the saddest photos I've ever seen, isn't it? Yeah. When you see the silhouette and they're all kind of blurred out and you just have Brett and you think, God, your heart breaks for the man.
Yeah, exactly. Like the tragedy even touches non-real Hart Foundation members or Hart family members. Like even the ones that are thrown into the mix end up having terrible fates. So
it's true because he lost a lot of people. Like not a lot of people know that Bryan Adams was somebody he was close to. He was close to Mr. Perfect, Rick Rude. You start naming all these individuals. Roddy was very close to him. He loses them all, and it's like, damn, I'm losing all my best friends in this insane yet wonderful business.
On that note, on the Bret Hart DVD, one of my like go-tos all the time is that in the outtakes or like the deleted scenes or whatever, he doesn't really cry through the whole the whole thing when he talks about all the people that he lost, but he does break down pretty hard when he starts talking about Rick Rude.
Yeah,
and it's in an outtake or in a deleted scene, and it's just heartbreaking. Yeah. And you don't really think of that being a person who's really close to him, but if you haven't seen that, go back and watch it, because that's a hard watch. I've watched it a billion times just because of the raw emotion of it, because Brett doesn't break that often when he does.
No.
And he has a lot to break for, right?
Yeah, and you're right, but Rick Rude was in the locker room at the time. He confirmed and brokered the deal kind of in some sense with WCW, because Eric questioned everything and thought, is this a work? What's going on? And he's the guy that called Eric personally and said, no, I was in there. This was real. They screwed the guy.
Yeah, right, exactly. And again, Rick Rude's another one of those guys that everybody has something good to say about.
I think Brett wrote a blog a long time ago. I was obsessed with these blogs that he would write about people that he respected, like The Undertaker and even some of his fallen comrades. And he did say Rick Rude was anything but rude. He was a man's man. He was the most loyal guy. He would give you the shirt off his back. He never took off his wedding ring in the ring.
Yeah, which is odd for that character. But
no kidding.
You don't really see... I've never really seen Rick Rude in like a real capacity, really, in terms of like a shooter or anything, where the real Rick Rude comes out. Have you?
No, not really. I mean, we saw maybe a little bit of that in ECW. He was there only briefly, a blip on the radar, and we got to see some of that attitude from him there. But we don't really get to see Rick Rude in his full glory, right?
Yeah, I'd love to see this wonderful man that everyone's always talking about. He's always in character. A great character, though.
No, it's true. So before we go much further, I do want to relive another really emotional moment that I do have trouble watching to this very day, Corey. So his desire to actively compete obviously led to his reliance on painkillers. Didn't bode well for his pre-existing heart condition, everything that he's gone through. And on the evening of WWF's Bad Blood, Pillman was found dead on October 5th, 1997 due to the heart failure. And he was scheduled to actually win, this is what they say, but who knows for sure, the Intercontinental Championship. If you watch, and I don't know the last time you've watched it, but man, I got goosebumps. I still do now. If you haven't watched the 10 Bell Salute the next evening on Raw, it's eerie. Owen, Bulldog, Anvil, Hawk, Vader, Rick Rude, all gone. No longer with us.
Yeah, they go fast and young. And actually, just touching on what we were just saying, there's actually a shot of Mark Merrill resting his head, or it looks like he's resting his head on Rick Rude's shoulder.
Oh, God.
Which is just, they just look so sad, which is, you know. And WWE excels at these little tribute things. The 10 Bell Salute is just, they nail it.
There's nothing more eerie than hearing that, is it? Like, yeah. I don't know if you've ever been there live for it, I've known people that have been there live, and when you watch it on TV and you hear the 10 Bell Salute, it doesn't matter who it is in terms of if it was somebody that I was connected to and I really appreciated, I always tear up because I think, God, you lose all that they are, but all that they could have been, and their family, and God, you feel horrible.
Absolutely. You haven't been. Have you been for a 10 Bell Salute?
No, I don't know if I could handle it, to be honest. It would probably haunt me. Pardon me?
I'd like to avoid those.
Oh,
personally.
God, yeah. I don't think you want to be there. But, I mean, you go relive this back in the day, and you see Eddie Guerrero, and you hear the montage with Johnny Cash's Hurt. I can't even go back and watch it. That's how emotional it is for me still.
Absolutely. I'm with you. And what is unfortunate about this, though, what kind of irks me a little bit is that we're talking about like how well they deal with that kind of stuff, the on-air stuff. But apparently... Vince McMahon, moments after finding out that Pillman passed away, Cornette's a little emotional, Jim Ross a little emotional, Pritchard's emotional, and within minutes after, apparently just tells him to angrily get their shit together. We got a show to do. And I was just like, okay. Sometimes, you know, the cutthroat is like, you know, understandable, but like, come on, buddy.
Have some sympathy, right?
Have some don't pull up your pants at that point. Just chill.
Yeah.
And I think later on there's some little controversy, I guess, around the idea that on the pay-per-view, I guess, he kind of indicates that it could have been a drug overdose.
Yeah.
Vince McMahon in the commentary does. And there's no indication that was the thing. But Bruce Pritchard thing, you know, indicates that it might have put that in people's mind a little bit, though I think it probably would have been in people's minds anyway, as that's one of the best ways to vilify wrestling.
Well, they also interviewed his wife, if you recall, too. They had her live, and that was a horrible tactic and just an awful idea all around, because you have this emotionally distraught person who just lost her loving husband. I believe at the time she was pregnant with another child, and all of a sudden she's on there basically trying to say, no, it wasn't drugs. It's like, God. But we know that that was a part of why he fell apart. There were many reasons.
Of course.
Drugs was one of them. We can't deny that.
Of course. And I don't know if you've seen Brian Pillman Jr., who's up and coming.
He's amazing.
Coming wrestler. He's amazing, yeah. But I guess he's estranged from his mother. Mm-hmm. And he talks a lot of smack about her going on the next day and doing that, and just talking about how tactless that was.
It was.
On her part. And he says a lot of other stuff about their relationship, that it was already over at that point and all that stuff. So he was a little upset about her getting a paycheck over that and all that stuff. There's a lot to say about that, but yeah, unfortunate.
Very much so. And again, too, the other thing is that Brian Pillman, you know, passes away. Jim Ross, always so great with his words, he's the one that said, we've always thought that he'd finally come to that realization that he couldn't physically do what he used to do because of the fused ankle. And even though the coroner said he had a heart attack, I often believe that Brian Pillman died of a broken heart. Which is just horrible. When you hear him say that, like, even to this day, that's one that still gets me. You can even hear it in my voice. That one hurts. That one definitely hurts.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how do you define a broken heart? A broken heart could be the drugs that you need to take to deal with your situation and your problems and all those things that affect your heart. You know, it's a broken heart could be more than a metaphor.
Yeah. So a couple last things before I ask for final thoughts. Brian Pillman became one of the greatest what-if stories, as we can agree, in wrestling. His controversial storylines became a staple in the Attitude Era. And really in the coming years, his trend of blurring these lines of kayfabe and reality really became the commonplace known as today's reality era. And really can't help but wonder what he would have achieved if he had a chance to continue his career throughout the years after his death, especially if he had stayed healthy. But either way, let's just say that he was less dependent on drugs, but his influence on the business will always be felt. So a couple questions for you, Corey. Will we ever see Brian Pillman in the WWE Hall of Fame?
That is such a grab bag of merit. Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
What? Maybe? That's almost insignificant, I'd say, because you just never know. There's a list a mile long already. And he was there shortly. But again, as Brian Pillman Jr. Said, his legacy is surprisingly long-lived. He's still relevant somehow. Like, not somehow, but he's still in the conversation despite a kind of a short career. So, you know, he still felt around the business. So,
what about your favorite Pillman moment or match?
I'd say favorite era is all the Hollywood Blonde stuff.
Yeah.
To me, that was obviously what's proven to be two of the best guys ever as a team.
A Flair for the Old. Do you remember that one? It's a Flair for the Old. Oh, yeah. Or he's mocking Arn, and he thinks that Arn's a statue. And he's like, oh, that's an actual living. Oh, it is Arn. So you see Austin and Brian playfully just tease Rick and Arn. And again, that was one that should have been a monster feud that drew money.
Yeah, you're right. Is that your favorite?
That's up there for me. I mean, I can't ever take it away from Brian Pillman and Jushin Thunder Liger, because that's where Liger became my all-time favorite Japanese wrestler, was actually from those matches.
Yeah, the drop kicking and at the same time and all that stuff. Just very entertaining and terrific and innovative as well.
And will we ever see a groundbreaking character this far ahead of his time in this era? Man or woman, are we ever going to see somebody that has this influence where you think, ooh, what they're doing now may not be appreciated, but 20 years from now it will be?
Not in the WWE. There's no room for that. There's no room for innovation. But AEW, I can see it happening for sure.
Mm.
There's room for innovation there. So, yeah, I think it's there's such a platform of chillness and not taking themselves too seriously, where there's room to experiment and stuff. And like I've heard Pillman be compared to like to Andy Kaufman, where it's just anything goes, and you need a place where you can be in anything goes kind of deal. And I guess another offspring of that idea is the Lunatic Fringe, I guess, right?
Yeah, in some respects, absolutely. Who also draws inspiration from Pillman, Funk, and actually the great Bruiser Brody.
Right. Yeah. So kind of he's carrying the legacy. How about you? Do you think groundbreaking characters? There's got to be. Good God, we're due for it.
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to see any of these groundbreaking characters that will have the influence like that, but I do believe, and I see some of the semblance of it now, the room for these original characters that are leaving their mark on the business. I mean, even as much as we can look at somebody like Orange Cassidy, and some will go, they scratch their head. But at the same time, I've always defended him to say he's got an original gimmick. He's drawing money. People are dressing like him. So this guy gets the business.
That's a perfect example. You're right. And he shouldn't have taken off as far as he did. And that it's basically, he's one of those guys who's surprising everyone, right? So
yeah,
it's obviously it's working, and he had some foresight there, obviously. I think that would work. Anyone else? I think maybe I'm hearing this, especially now that we're in the middle of this WrestleMania, where these movies that take place outside of the wrestling of the actual matches, like which basically innovated and created by Matt Hardy. I guess that's an evolutionary step. So
that's true too. Maybe, and The Fiend. You can't overlook The Fiend. I mean, for what he's done, he brought the theatrics back to wrestling in some respects. And yes, it's that, suspension of disbelief, so to speak. But at the same time, you think, wow, this is refreshing. We haven't seen this in a long time.
Of course. Well, we need, I don't know if that's necessarily innovative, but it is falling back on a method that I prefer. Like, we need a new Undertaker, right? We need someone to carry that that scary, menacing, surreal, supernatural character. And absolutely, we need those. So,
one thing we can, innovative but reliable. One thing we can agree upon: Brian Pillman, often imitated, never quite duplicated. This concludes another episode of the Pro Wrestling Stories podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate the support. Join us for future episodes. We'll do a lot more deep dives into the archives, focusing on wrestlers such as Brian Pillman and, of course, their influence on the business. We'll bring these articles to life in audio form. It's your nostalgic trip, if you will. So listen and subscribe to future episodes wherever you get your podcasts, and follow Pro Wrestling Stories on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Stories and on Twitter, PWS_official. From Chris Toplak and Corey Rivard, happy trails to you. Until we meet again.
Ow, it's not hot.